Great to have you with us today. Welcome to Red Ice Radio. My name is Henrik, and I hope you've had a good weekend and that you're enjoying spring if you're up in the Northern Hemisphere. It's certainly going slow up here in Scandinavia, no heat to speak of, and still very cold, although we're almost into May now. But the days are getting longer and brighter, finally. More radio on all kinds of fascinating and enlightening topics is something that you can find at Red Ice Creations. .com, our website. Bread and circuses, that's the superficial means of appeasement in the Roman Empire, a concept that certainly has survived the transformation of the Roman expansionist government, which we still, to a large extent, suffer under today. In the past, we've spent at least a few shows talking about the circuses part of this concept, but today we're going to look closer at the bread, literally the wheat, the food that have kept people happy and docile for thousands of years. In all kinds of shapes and forms, it comes onto our plates, not only as bread, pasta and pastries, but wheat is in everything these days. Dr. William Davis, cardiologist and seeker of truth in health, is with us to expose healthy whole grains for the incredibly destructive genetic monster they've become. Dr. Davis will discuss the benefits of going wheat-free. We'll cover the genetic changes wheat has gone through versus the ancient grains. Modern wheat is an opiate and an appetite stimulant, believed to be a big reason why many people today are overweight and even pre-diabetic or diabetic. William also breaks down the internal components of wheat and how they interact with the body in negative ways linked to a slew of health problems. A very important hour with William Davis ahead. Welcome to Red Ice Radio, William Davis. It is great to have you with us. First of all, thank you for taking the time talking with us here today.
Oh, my pleasure.
This is really really good stuff. I heard an interview with you over at Gnostic Media with our friend Jan Irvin, a really good one. I wanted to invite you on as well to talk a little bit more about some of your research material and highlight some of this to our audience as well. Really interesting and important material. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the origins, I guess, of your research into this? Why did you want to study, and when did you begin studying wheat, William?
Well, I got into this area very seriously when it became very frustrating to me and very concerning that in my heart disease prevention practice, where I tried to identify all the hidden causes for heart disease, which, by the way, extend far beyond this notion of high cholesterol. I call that the kindergarten version of heart disease. So and in my effort to look for all the causes of heart disease, one of the things you have to control is blood sugar. And in the U.S., 80% of the people coming through my office for heart disease prevention showed high blood sugars in the pre-diabetic or diabetic range. And so the conventional notion, of course, is these people are gluttonous and lazy, and that's why they have diabetes or pre-diabetes, and they should cut their fat and eat more healthy whole grains. But there's a very simple fact often overlooked in that advice, and that is wheat raises blood sugar higher than nearly all other foods. Not all foods, but nearly all other foods, such that two slices of whole wheat bread raise blood sugar higher than 6 teaspoons of table sugar. That's a simple fact that you can see in any table of glycemic index, even though it's often ignored. So I used that very simple observation in these patients. I said, well, let's just try taking wheat out of your diet and see what happens to blood sugar, because control of blood sugar is essential for control over heart disease risk. So people would do this. They do this and come back about 3 months, 4 months, 6 months later, and their fasting blood glucose, their fasting sugar, would indeed be much lower. Hemoglobin A1C, which is an index of your prior 2 months of blood sugar, would be dramatically lower. But they told me all kinds of other things that I did not expect. I lost 30 pounds. I lost 4 inches from my waist. The migraine headaches I had for 15 years every day without fail are now gone. My acid reflux is gone completely. I stopped my 3 drugs, my irritable bowel syndrome, bowel urgency, gas and cramps, and diarrhea is completely gone. My leg swelling is gone. My joint pain, the pain I had for years, my fingers and wrists, and they called it rheumatoid arthritis, is gone. I stopped all the drugs. My ulcerative colitis, my Crohn's disease is so improved, I'm off two drugs. They're thinking about stopping a third, and they canceled my colon surgery. In other words, I saw by accident all the incredible things that came from my simple effort to reduce blood sugar. So, you know, when this first happened, I dismissed it. I told patients, you know, I have no idea why your rheumatoid arthritis is better. Well, I'm grateful, but I don't know why.
Right.
But after you see it hundreds and now many, many, many thousands of times, and you see it very consistently and reproducibly, you realize there is something very, very wrong. That's when I start to ask, why? Why would the removal of this one component of diet yield such extravagant and unexpected changes?
Absolutely. It's remarkable. I've myself tried this on and off successfully here and there. I had a piece of bread yesterday and I feel guilty about it, but, you know, it's very difficult. What happens in the body then when we eat it? Why is it so difficult to exclude bread and pasta and all these things?
Well, it is ubiquitous. It's everywhere. You know, in 1970, this was not true. Wheat was pretty much in wheat products. You would find wheat, of course, in bread and rolls and donuts and cookies and cakes. In 2012, you find it in those foods, but you find it in everything else. You find it in soup, instant soup, salad dressing, prepared foods, frozen foods, licorice, candy, granola, breakfast. In other words, it is in virtually everything. Now, I've got to ask why. And I can tell you why I think wheat is now included in everything. And that is the changes introduced into the wheat plant in the 1970s. That is, these were genetic changes, not genetic modification, by the way. The whole notion of genetic modification, that is the use of gene splicing technology to insert or delete genes, that didn't start in the mid-80s or so. So this, all the changes, the extensive changes introduced into wheat predate the use of genetic modification. But it does not mean these techniques were somehow benign. They're quite substantial and can change the genetics of a plant significantly. But wheat was changed in the 70s. Mostly in an effort to increase yield. And one of the changes introduced was the creation of a short, stocky, semi-dwarf strain that stands about 24 inches or 2 feet high. As you know, traditional wheat stands about shoulder height, about 4.5 or 5 feet high.
Mm-hmm.
Well, part of the effort to create a high-yield strain is a very short strain because the short stalk occupies, requires less fertilizer for this otherwise useless stalk. It also is more resistant to wind and storms, such that traditional wheat after a storm can flop over and the farmer can't harvest or thresh. And this short, stocky plant is much more resistant to that. But what the geneticists did not understand is you cannot change one thing, such as height or yield, without changing other characteristics. And one of the changes introduced was several amino acids changes in the gliadin protein of wheat. So we know for a fact, for instance, that the GLI alpha 9 pardon me, sequence in modern wheat is absent from older forms of wheat. And that, by the way, is the antigen, the sequence that is responsible likely for the explosion in celiac disease here, Sweden, UK, Western Europe, etc. The GLIA alpha 9 sequence is almost ubiquitous in modern wheat now. So the gliadin protein has been changed. One of the changes that accompanied these shifts in amino acid structure of the gliadin protein is that it became a very potent stimulant of appetite, such that when modern wheat hit the store shelves in the U.S., that happened in the early to mid-80s, such that by 1985, everything you bought, in the U.S. at least, was from the dwarf strain of wheat. So all breads, rolls, cookies, cakes, pretzels, crackers, etc., all came from the dwarf strain with this new form of gliadin. When this form of wheat hit the shelves and replaced all traditional sources of wheat, we watched calorie intake increase 440 calories per day. per person, 365 days per year. It's an awful lot of calories.
Yeah.
And you and your listeners know what happens after that. There's an inevitable increase in weight. If you there's a lag of 30, 50, 60 pounds of weight gain, and you expect to see diabetes, and of course that's exactly what happened. We're in the midst of the world's worst epidemic of diabetes ever seen since man has walked on Earth.
Yeah.
Now, of course, the blame is placed on us that we are gluttonous and lazy, and we drink soft drinks, and we watch TV all day, and we sit around, and we're lazy. And I think that's true for a small segment of the population, perhaps for 14-year-old kids playing video games all day. But I think most responsible, health-conscious adults are not gluttonous and are not lazy. In fact, you'll see the 230-pound woman exercising every day for 90 minutes. So this whole situation has led to a whole collection of perverse interpretations and advice. Eat less fat, eat more healthy whole grains, and if you get fat and diabetic, it's your own darn fault. But it took the removal of wheat for me to see this play out. And I now have a long list, including myself, by the way, of former diabetics. That is, people who had high blood sugars, who were told they needed medications or insulin. You remove wheat, you remove the gliadin protein appetite stimulant. Now, another aspect of wheat, and this is not clear whether this is a new issue or not, but it is an issue unique to problematic for modern wheat, and that is the amylopectin A. Amylopectin A is the unique form of carbohydrate in wheat. We're often told that complex carbohydrates are better for us than simple carbohydrates.
Right.
Well, that's not entirely true. So the complex carbohydrate unique to wheat, the unique branching structure called amylopectin A in wheat, is highly digestible by the enzyme amylase in the mouth and in the stomach. And it thereby raises blood sugar higher and faster than 6 teaspoons of table sugar, a simple sugar.
Wow.
So when we're told to eat more complex carbohydrates, like whole wheat and whole grains, what we're being told in effect is to eat a food that raises blood sugar high like candy. And if we do that many times a day, as many people do, as you know, many people have a wheat-based cereal for breakfast. They have pretzels or wheat crackers for a snack. They have maybe low-fat turkey breast on 2 slices of whole wheat bread for lunch. They have whole wheat pasta for dinner. In other words, we have a wheat-dominated diet. Well, you have exposure to the amylopectin A repeatedly, high blood sugars repeatedly, and that triggers resistance to insulin. And it also cultivates the growth of visceral fat in the abdomen. And that combination of events leads us down the path of diabetes and prediabetes, as well as inflammatory phenomena. So we have this amylopectin A raising blood sugar very high. We have the gliadin protein, this new gliadin protein that's an appetite stimulant. It's as if wheat is a perfectly crafted tool for obesity. And it doesn't end there, by the way. There's even more.
There sure is. This is just amazing listening to this. If we go back to the 70s briefly, before this dwarf strain, was it still okay back then, do you think? If we went back to that now, that's what I'm saying, would wheat be an okay food, in your opinion?
I think it's better. I think what we see is every step we take back in the history of wheat, it gets better and better. So if we went back to the wheat that our mothers had, say, in 1950, it's better. If we go back to the wheat of the Middle Ages, like spelt or kamut, it's even better. If we go back to the wheat of the Bible, which is the 28-chromosome form of wheat called emmer, and by the way, modern wheat is a 42-chromosome plant. If we go back even farther to the wheat that precedes even biblical times, that is einkorn, a 14-chromosome plant, it gets even more benign. Now, I think none of these wheats, though, are entirely benign. And we know that because in the fossil evidence, in the archaeological evidence, when humans incorporated grains, there were consequences for health. There was more bone disease. There were probably more vascular disease. In other words, the incorporation of grains into the hunter-gatherer diet was not an entirely benign process. So it's likely that grains were never good for humans, though I would crudely estimate that einkorn and emmer are probably about 80 to 90% better. So a decision we've all got to make is, well, gee, should we embrace some of these older forms of wheat and accept they might not be perfect? Maybe they're good for occasional indulgences. My personal view is if your goal is ideal health, not just an incremental benefit, if your goal is ideal health, you eat nothing made of wheat, no matter how far back you go. Hmm. I am getting these questions from farmers. You know, Canada, of course, is a major wheat exporter.
Hmm.
And they have lots and lots of acreage devoted to wheat cultivation. And I'm getting, to their great credit, I'm getting lots of questions from farmers and farmers associations asking, well, you know, we hear what you're saying. We don't want to contribute to killing people and making them sick. Should we bring back, for instance, Red Fife? Red Fife is the wheat of the 19th century, which is very popular in the 19th century. And, you know, I think I'm very impressed. They're even thinking about it because what they're asking, in effect, is should we resurrect these older forms of wheat that have far less yield? In other words, these forms of wheat, particularly grown with organic techniques, might yield 10% per acre of the yield of modern wheat. So I'm very, very gratified they're even thinking about it.
Hmm.
One of the problems, of course, is you and I have never had Red Fife, more than likely.
Hmm.
Nor do I know anybody who's had it. So it's hard to know, and of course there's no studies you and I can reference. There's no such thing as 1,000 people observed eating Red Fife. So it's a lot of this is speculation. A lot of it's putting together it's putting together what little we know about these things. But I believe after all is said and done, the safest route is to say, well, all wheat, as you go back in time, gets better. It never becomes entirely benign.
I see. Wheat germ, we hear, is loaded with vitamins and minerals. So can this also, form of wheat, cause health problems? And furthermore, sprouted wheat bran, there's a number of these we hear. What's your opinion on these?
Ironically, yes, so wheat germ does contain good things, but it is also the most concentrated source of wheat lectins, wheat germ gluten. In other words, plants have protective mechanisms. You and I have antibodies and T cells and lymphocytes. Plants don't have such complex immune protection. They have something called lectins. So lectins are meant to be poisons. They're meant to be poisons to bacteria, molds, insects, etc. Now, lots of plants have lectins, and they're mostly benign. In other words, spinach and broccoli and things we regard as very safe and have not been associated with health problems have lectins, and those are benign lectins. But not all lectins are benign. And the one that stands apart is the lectin from wheat germ agglutinin, which is indigestible. So when you ingest it, especially in highly concentrated form in wheat germ, this thing gains access to your intestinal tract. It has direct toxic effect. And so it's well established that people with celiac disease, for instance, a lot of this destruction of their intestinal tract is mediated via immune mechanisms. But a good deal of the damage is not via an immune mechanism, but via the direct toxic effects of wheat germ agglutinin. In fact, if you give wheat germ agglutinin to an experimental animal, that is not wheat germ, but just wheat germ agglutinin in the wheat germ, it causes intestinal destruction. Wheat germ agglutinin also is very unique in that it has the odd capacity to, in effect, unlock the normal barriers in your intestine and let foreign substances ready access into your bloodstream.
Hmm.
This is probably why people who consume wheat and thereby wheat germ agglutinin have more inflammatory diseases like rheumatoid arthritis and polymyalgia rheumatica and Hashimoto's thyroiditis, because there's a flood of foreign substances into the bloodstream because of wheat germ agglutinin. So ironically, yes, there are good things in wheat germ, but there's also this very bad thing called wheat germ agglutinin. Wheat bran is, of course, just wood, essentially. It's cellulose. It's inert. Now, I wouldn't advocate that because there are enough people who are very sensitive to any gluten or gliadin residues that it can provoke reactions. And so, and there's nothing really essential. I think that's another fiction propagated by the food industry. Most of the data suggesting that fiber is good for us refers to the fiber from vegetables and fruit and nuts and seeds, not the fiber from grains. And so you can do quite well without these added fibers from grains, and I fear the contamination of the bran with other things in wheat. Sprouting the seeds doesn't really change the basic structure. In other words, if you sprout the seed and then make your bread, it still has lectins. It still has gliadin, the unique gliadin stimulates appetite. Mm-hmm. It still has gluten. In other words, if you sprout it and you reduce, say, the amylopectin A content by 5% or 10% or even 30%, you've still got all the other problems in wheat. And I've seen this play out, by the way, many times. People say, I'm wheat-free. I've been wheat-free now for 8 weeks. But I found this sprouted grain bread, and I tried it, and I got sick. Joint pain. Yeah. I got joint pains. I got diarrhea. And by the way, I should mention, those are very common, what I call, for lack of a better term, re-exposure reactions. So those of us who've been wheat-free for any length of time get very ill when we are re-exposed, either intentionally or inadvertently. Yeah. So if you have, for instance, let's say breading on your fish, because you went out to dinner and you've got to ask the waiter, and you find a piece of breaded fish on your plate, and you say, well, what the heck, I've been good for 3 months now, I'll go ahead and eat it. Looks pretty darn good. You have it. Before you know it, you're running to the toilet with cramps, diarrhea, and gas, or joint pains. Women can experience anxiety. Men can get rage. In other words, you get very clear-cut reactions, most common reactions, just like food poisoning. So I take that to be an important lesson. If we are free of this thing and consume it again, and we have a food poisoning-like reaction, I take that to mean this thing can't be good for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I hear that. Okay, that is very valuable information, very, very interesting to hear that. Do you think that all of this is, from the farmer's point of view, for the ease of farming, this is high yield, is this the primary force driving this, or is there such a thing as the wheat industry, if you will?
I think all those things do. I paint this as a very messy business, but it was created originally in the 60s and 70s as part of a noble cause. So the geneticists who originally set out to do this did it to help solve world hunger. So it wasn't an evil plot. It was an effort to help increase yield because you may recall in the 60s and 70s there was terrible fear of world population explosion, that we'd have billions of people in China and India and Pakistan and Africa all starving. And so there was great investment in generating high-yield strains of crops, not just wheat, but also corn, soy, and others. And that's where wheat came from. And it was successful. They did indeed increase yield. So when it was introduced in the U.S., in North and South Dakota, Minnesota, Montana, a lot of the wheat-producing states, it was embraced slowly. Because when the farmers saw this peculiar-looking 2-foot-tall dwarf, they didn't trust it. But when they saw some of their colleagues growing this wheat and seeing as much as a 10-fold increased yield per acre, they couldn't help but notice. And so once it gained some traction, some farmers began to grow it. Other farmers watched this incredible yield and rapidly embraced it. In third world countries of that age, famine was converted to surplus within a year. And there would be piles of wheat surplus when just a year earlier there were lines of starving people. So it was a huge success story when judged by yield. So it opens a question, though, that's gotten even worse, and that is over the years. And that is, how much can geneticists and agribusiness change our food and yet not test it, not tell us? In the U.S., for instance, there's a piece of legislation. You probably know this. There's a piece of legislation from Congress called the Truth in Labeling Act. It's been there for a couple of years, and it's being fought very vigorously by agribusiness such as Monsanto. Monsanto alone, one company, spends $2.2 to $2.4 billion per quarter, every 3 months, to fight this piece of legislation and other similar legislation. But all this piece of legislation says is if someone genetically changes your food, they have to say so on the label, period. It doesn't say we're going to shut it down. It doesn't say we're going to scrutinize genetic modification. It doesn't mean we're going to put a moratorium on it. It just says if you do it, please let us know. So the fact that agribusiness is fighting so vigorously to oppose this legislation tells me their attitude is it's none of your darn business if we change your food. We're going to do it, and we don't want to tell you.
Yeah.
And so whether it's the extensive hybridization techniques, the back crossing, the introduction of unique genetic sets into the wheat plant, or whether it's genetic modification in the more modern era of corn, like glyphosate resistance or BT toxin insertion, or whether it's genetic modification of potatoes that essentially makes laboratory animals sick and die, this is all part of a broad effort to change your food, not for our purposes so much now, but to suit the purposes, the agenda of agribusiness. And so that's what we're up against. And they are incredibly well-funded and powerful. How many companies can afford to spend $10 billion a year just to lobby the government?
Mm.
That's just, and that's at the federal level. That's not even counting state and local.
Mm.
So it's very difficult for you and me to wage a fight. And these people are very capable, very well-funded, and very capable of manipulating the media. I've seen that play out in the last several months, too.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. So on this level, where we have the power to make the choices, what we choose to buy and what we choose to eat, obviously, this is where the power lies, because we can't lobby on the same. Well, maybe we could if we had somebody, people who could pull this together, but that's not happening right now. Monsanto is very powerful. They have their people in the government, swing door politics, etc. I mean, this is borderline genocidal, if you want to look at it from that point of view. I mean, considering the few tests that have been done so far on soy and some other foods, the GMO question is completely out of hand, and we don't know what we're doing. It's very very disheartening when you actually look at the data on these things.
I agree. Yet this stuff is being sold. It's in our food already. That's the incredible thing. And we're seeing all these peculiar things happen to people, and often ourselves being blamed for these things. So, yeah, so that's why I tell people, talk to people like you and webcasts, et cetera, because we've got to organize and talk. I look at this as like the Arab Spring. If we're being oppressed by Muammar Gaddafi and we can't say these things in the press or on the airwaves, we do it ourselves. We do it in such things as websites and blogs and social media because we have to. Because last I checked, I don't have $10 billion in my account to pay for my marketing efforts. So we've got to do it like this. We've got to educate people and tell them the science is already out there. And it's very, very disturbing that what science we have that's independent, produced independently of the agribusiness companies, tells us this stuff ain't good. This stuff induces odd changes in experimental animals. It induces peculiar and unexpected changes in soil microorganisms. It might be associated with stillbirths and the wiping out of livestock. So I fear it's going to take catastrophe in humans before these issues are taken seriously.
Bread and mankind seems to go hand in hand at this point. Unfortunately, it's a huge part of our culture, of you know, how we've been living in the past. But in your opinion, what grains should we be eating? What could we switch to? We have millet, kamut, rye. There's other oats, quinoa, amaranth, for instance. What's your take on this?
Well, let me step away then from the wheat belly conversation. So one of the criticisms of wheat belly is that the diet I advocate is really a low carbohydrate diet, and that's true. So the arguments I try to make are one that wheat is changed and is responsible for an incredible amount of destructive effects in health, like acid reflux and other gastrointestinal changes, joint pains, inflammatory diseases, diabetes, etc. But because it's not fair to people to point your finger at a problem and not offer a solution, I offer this. If your goal is ideal health, then you've got to go further. In other words, if I said to you, I'd like everybody to eliminate wheat, but it's okay to eat all the jelly beans and ice cream you want. That's not smart either.
Right.
And so I take it a step further. If your goal is ideal health, if all anyone did was take wheat out of the diet, there is no question there are extensive and dramatic changes in health, even if you do not limit other – even if you did cut out wheat and eat lots of ice cream and jelly beans, you're still far better off, but you're not eating an ideal diet. So if the question is, okay, we're going to eliminate this terrible, worst thing of all in diet, that is wheat. But we want to go farther because we'd like to, as much as possible, take full advantage of diet for ideal health. Well, we have another problem. Most people I talk to or meet for the first time are terribly overweight or overtly obese. And they often are diabetic or pre-diabetic. They often have heart disease, whether they know it or not. They often have other health problems. And so for the most rapid reversal of all these phenomena, I advocate limiting other carbohydrates. And so the other grains you're talking about, such as millet, quinoa, the non-wheat grains, that is, teff, amaranth, are pretty much carbohydrate challenges. And that's it. In other words, they don't have destructive lectins. They don't have the appetite-stimulating effect of wheat, the gliadin. They don't have some of the unique alpha amylases that wheat has that are generating unique allergies. So that all those things are absent from these other non-wheat grains. But they do raise blood sugar, and they can raise blood sugar a lot. Now, one of the problems with this is individual susceptibility to carbohydrates varies widely. In other words, the way a 23-year-old, 108-pound premenopausal female who likes to run marathons is going to be very different from the carbohydrate sensitivity of a 293-pound, 60-year-old, obese, diabetic male. So it's tough to say everybody should do such and such.
Right,
but I will say that most modern Europeans and Americans have gotten to adulthood and have overtaxed, overchallenged, beaten up and kicked their poor pancreatic beta cells, that is the cells that produce insulin, such that many of us are in a declining mode of having lost substantial beta cell function, and you cannot recover in a practical way your beta cells. So if I've been eating breakfast cereals, breakfast toast, pasta and sandwiches, and I've beaten my pancreas up, and let's say I now have only 78% of my original beta cell capacity to make insulin, yet I continue to challenge it by feeding myself, let's say, millet or quinoa, that is a substantial carbohydrate load, and I overtax my pancreas, I will take a few steps closer to diabetes with each meal. So I do advocate, if your goal is ideal health, to limit exposure to other carbohydrates. Because I see this every day. Now, I see sick people. I see people who come to me because they already have heart disease and other metabolic distortions. Perhaps I'm overreacting because I have to unwind these phenomena in these people who come to see me. But the people I see look like often healthy people. That is, we're not talking about people who are morbidly obese often. We're often talking about people who are just a few pounds overweight who yet have incredible metabolic distortions identified by blood tests and so on. So by the way, when you do that, when you observe human health from the perspective of these metabolic markers, you realize that people who often think they're healthy are not. And you can see incredible changes develop when people, one, eliminate wheat, and then, two, limit their exposure to other junk carbohydrates. I should mention that one common misunderstanding is that gluten-free foods are good. Gluten-free foods are terrible. That's very confusing. In other words, most food manufacturers of gluten-free foods make their foods. They're multi-grain gluten-free bread, for instance, with no wheat or gluten, of course. And instead, they use rice starch, tapioca starch, potato starch, or corn starch, the very few carbohydrates that raise blood sugar even higher than wheat and sugar. So those are very, very poor replacements for wheat. Unfortunately, that seems to be a popular solution. if wheat is bad and gluten-free is good, let's eat gluten-free foods. And so what I try to do is educate people that the commercially produced gluten-free foods are destructive. But you can make your very own, very healthy gluten-free foods, but you've got to use different ingredients. You can't use those junk carbohydrates. And so the recipes, for instance, the recipes in the Wheat Belly book, the recipes I try to post about once a week in my Wheat Belly blog, are wheat-free, of course, gluten-free, and free of those junk carbohydrates. But you can still have, if you're shown how, you can have cupcakes, you can have muffins and breads and pies and cheesecake, but you make it differently.
Yeah. I definitely want to talk more about your book and some of the recipes and other things a little bit later here. The diabetic issue is a huge one, of course, but if we look at the overweight issue a little bit, I remember a while back, if you make a simple, you know, sauce or whatever, you have water and white flour, and you mix that in, right? You can see how it swells up. It stiffens a little bit in a way. Is a similar thing happening in the body? Is this what happens to how we get overweight? We have water building up in a way with the flour, or how would you explain that? Why are we getting overweight?
I think there is a water retaining effect. It's an effect I don't fully understand. So when you first eliminate wheat from your diet, there's very rapid weight loss for most, not all, for most people. It's not uncommon in the first 10 days to lose a pound a day. Now, it's not all fat. There is fat loss, a lot of fat loss, and there's a very dramatic reduction in waist size for most people. 2 inches lost in 2 weeks is not uncommon. It's an everyday occurrence with wheat elimination. But I think a lot of the weight loss is water, too. And you've heard this before in other diets, the Atkins diet, for instance, when people do the induction phase. They take out all carbohydrates and they eat the meat and cheese and bacon and all that stuff. There's a dramatic weight loss, some of which is water.
Yes.
But why, I'm not entirely sure. It might be partly because of the lack of inflammation. So part of inflammation is porosity, increased retention of water. And there is an increased diuresis or loss of water when you first go wheat-free, and also low carbohydrate even adds to that.
So, William, does that mean that it's important to also continue drinking a lot of water so we don't damage the body this way if we drop wheat?
Yeah, that's right. So a lot of people become dehydrated in the first couple of weeks or so because of this water loss. And so many people have to compensate by drinking more fluids. Oddly, many people have to add more salt also. Another interesting example of how we turn conventional advice on its head, that is the conventional advice to cut your salt and sodium, we are in effect increasing it. Because we've got people now, it's a common occurrence to have a formerly hypertensive person on two drugs to maintain normal blood pressure is now lightheaded with a blood pressure of 95 on no drugs. That person has to drink more fluid, perhaps has a lot more leeway for using salt. So a lot of the conventional notions of health and how to achieve health are being turned on their heads by this experience.
Hmm. Do you know if there's any vitamin companies that use wheat to coat their supplement? I mean, again, you mentioned that wheat is in everything. Is this something that you're aware of? For instance, when we take supplements, vitamins, minerals, and things, you could sometimes find that there is wheat in there. Do you know if that's the case?
That's absolutely the case. It's not real common, and it's becoming less common, but it is in tablets and caplets and supplements. A lot of drugs have it, too. So, the most exquisitely gluten-sensitive have to be extremely vigilant about that, because if you're otherwise perfect, but you're taking a tablet with a little bit of a flour or gluten content, that may be enough in very sensitive people. So, yes, it pays to examine the label. It helps to contact manufacturer if necessary. There are websites that make listings, particularly for the drugs, that will tell you whether or not there's gluten or wheat. You could try asking the pharmacist, but this issue hasn't really gotten the attention of most pharmacists yet. So while you can try, it's often not very helpful. But yes, this is yet another potential exposure.
Gluten allergies have just exploded, as we kind of alluded to. Is it because of this dwarf strand you mentioned before, or is something else happening? Is mankind maybe developing a resistance to this strand of wheat that we currently have? Could it be in the future that we just can see mankind can't tolerate this at all? What do you think?
Well, let me first qualify by saying by wheat allergy, of course, what we mean is the immunoglobulin E response. That is true allergy. Because lots of people will say things like, I get diarrhea from wheat, I have a wheat allergy. Well, that's not an allergy in the strictest sense. That's probably the lectins. That's probably the gliadin. So true wheat allergy, that is a hay fever-like response, it is on the increase, as it is to peanuts and soy and lots of other foods, particularly in kids. It's not entirely clear why that's happening. One probable reason is the shift in alpha amylase structure. There, when efforts have been made to identify the specific allergens in wheat that trigger these allergic responses, there's about a dozen of them. So it's not just one. And one person's allergy to wheat, say, expressed a sinus congestion, may be different from the allergen another person who experiences asthma from wheat. But the most common allergen in wheat is the alpha amylase, the different structures of alpha amylase, which, by the way, have been shown to be different in 2012 than, say, in 1960.
Yeah. If so many health problems are hinged on wheat, why do you think it is that doctors aren't talking more about this?
I think they've been lulled by the conventional notion of eating more healthy whole grains. There are five large studies that, for the most part, show that if you replace white enriched flour with whole grains, there are health benefits. And that is indisputable. There's no question. Those data are quite solid. If you replace white enriched flour products and processed foods with the whole grain foods, there are, the evidence suggests, less diabetes, less hypertension, less heart disease, less cancer. No question. But I think the clearest way to show the flaw in that logic is to tell everyone that if you follow this flawed sequence of logic, if you take something bad for you and you replace it with something less bad for you, and there's an apparent health benefit, you should not conclude that a whole bunch of that less bad thing is good for you. So the analogy I make is if you take unfiltered Tarryton cigarettes and you replace it with filtered Salem cigarettes, and there's an apparent health benefit, should we conclude that we should smoke lots of Salems? Of course not. And you'll see, by the way, that flawed sequence of logic applies to many ideas in nutrition. It's not just wheat and whole grains. It's actually many things. Something bad, which plays something less bad, a whole bunch less bad thing is good for you. And for some reason, nutrition is dominated by that very flawed logic. This would not work in physics. It wouldn't work in electrical engineering. But it seems to be endemic. It seems to be very common in nutritional thinking.
Wheat is an opiate, as you wrote recently on your blog, wheatbellyblog.com. Do you think most people that cut out wheat suffer from withdrawal symptoms?
I would say about 35% of people experience a very distinct and very unpleasant withdrawal syndrome. So exactly right. If this thing is an opiate and can be blocked, by the way, with opiate-blocking drugs, it's binding to opiate receptors and the brain can be blocked with opiate-blocking drugs, removing it by not eating wheat generates a withdrawal syndrome in about a third of people. And it's typically overwhelming fatigue, no energy, inability to exercise, and sometimes sadness and depression. And it lasts as short as a day or two, usually 3 to 5 days, and occasionally much longer, in weeks. The longest I've ever seen it go is 4 weeks. Thankfully, that's rare. But it's very, very distinct. And it can also come back. In other words, if you, let's say, go wheat-free for several months, you feel better, but then you are convinced by somebody that, gee, it's not so bad after all. You go back, you reincorporate grains back into your diet. You can get very sick and go through withdrawal syndrome all over again. So it's a very, very reproducible phenomenon.
Wheat rehab.
By the way, that's right. There is a drug company, by the way, there's a drug company that filed its application for the drug naltrexone. Naltrexone's already on the market. It's an opiate-blocking drug taken by heroin addicts. because it blocks their high. So it encourages staying away from heroin, which is very difficult to stay away from. Well, this drug company made its application to the FDA a year ago in the U.S. for the drug naltrexone for weight loss, because in their clinical trials, people who take opiate-blocking drug lose about 26 pounds in the first 6 months because they cut their calorie consumption 400 calories per day. That application, by the way, is still pending.
Okay. The full title of the book, I want to mention, The Wheat Belly, Lose the Wheat, Lose the Weight, and Find Your Path Back to Health. The website set up for the book specifically is wheatbellybook.com. Tell us a little bit more about the book and some of the recipes that you have in there and some of the things that we might not have touched upon that you consider to be really important points for people to know.
Sure. Well, so we should be eating real food, not wheat. We shouldn't eat junk carbohydrates like gluten-free foods. And so we're left with things like, obviously, vegetables, avocados and olives and olive oil, and meats and poultry and fish and eggs. And we should eat the yolks, of course. Cheeses, dairy. Dairy, of course, has its own set of concerns. And so I don't think we need to go into that, but there's bovine growth hormone, some other issues. So we have to be a little bit selective about our dairy. But overall, we just eat real food. And that simple approach, and you'll witness incredible turnarounds in health. You'll see dramatic weight loss. So fat consumption has nothing to do with weight gain. And you can have all the fat you want. Now, most people are pretty good all on their own. Coming up with their own spinach salad and lamb chops and baked salmon. So the recipes I've been coming up with are to help people replace those things they're going to miss. How do you replace a sandwich, for instance? How do you replace cupcakes? Or maybe you're going to have company over your house on Saturday, and what do you serve them? You'd like to eat it with your company, too. So how do you serve, let's say, cheesecake and enjoy it as well, not get sick or suffer health consequences. So my recipes are tilted more towards trying to replace those kinds of foods. So there's lots of recipes for muffins and cookies and cakes and so on. Not to some people, unfortunately, have interpreted that as meaning we should live on cupcakes and muffins. But those are the things that I'm trying to fill the holes in people's diets. I think this works quite well. So you can have a three-egg omelet for breakfast with spinach and mushrooms and olive oil. But maybe you'd like to have something in addition to that. And so you can have, for instance, a muffin or chocolate chip cookies or brownies. But you won't suffer the health consequence that ordinarily accompany those kinds of foods.
Is it the same, though? I mean, I think it's weird, this thing that we want to have it, but not want to have it at the same time. It's a mental thing. We have to get over that addiction in a way. But the recipes that you have in your book, would you say that they're close, or are they getting close to the original, or are they different in that way, tasting and such?
Some are. I think I've gotten perfectly. Now, some of the more recent recipes that come out in the blog are probably among the best, to be honest, because I've had more time and we've gotten a lot more input. So I posted a recipe for a focaccia bread that is, if I don't mind saying myself, quite excellent. It's a rosemary focaccia bread. It is a perfect sandwich bread. The chocolate chip cookies are very good. So there's plenty of recipes that are very good. Some of the recipes, though, if you're comparison was how close does it come to its wheat equivalent, you might be disappointed. In other words, you might say, well, gee, these muffins are a little heavier, they're denser, they're not as sweet, so they're not perfect reproductions. Some are, but some are not. Here's something odd. The longer you're wheat-free, the more sensitive you become to sweetness. And so that's something I've had to incorporate into these recipes.
Yes.
We do use some sweeteners like stevia or erythritol, which I believe are fairly benign sweeteners.
Yeah, that's what I've heard as well. Erythritol seems like a very good option. I mean, as we know, aspartame and all these others, they're horrendous for you. But erythritol seems pretty good.
Yeah, we're seeing no real problems with these things, aside from some people complain of a bitter taste with the stevia. But putting aside that perceived thing, a taste, you don't really need that much. In other words, if you were to go back after you've been wheat free, say for several months, and you go back to a conventional sweet or indulgence, you're going to find it sickeningly sweet. And so there's a great reduction in your desire for sweet and enhanced perception of sweetness. But a little bit might be nice once in a while. You know, a holiday comes around and you want to share, say, a pie with friends and family, or because whether we like it or not, not everybody's going to follow our lead in the diet. And I'll tell you, when I've served these wheat-free recipes to people who are not wheat-free, they were impressed with, gee, this tastes pretty good. But it might be a little bit different.
Absolutely. Mankind has a tendency to go for the sweet things, honey, maple syrup, molasses, and there's good things in there too. We need a certain set of that as well, correct?
I think we need it. You know, it's part of socialization, it's part of friends and family, it's part of sharing, it's part of the community of eating. So I think there is a need for that aspect of it. A true physiologic need, that I'm not so sure about.
Okay.
I think we can do without. You know, if you put your foot down and said, I must have some kind of sweetener, I would say probably the most benign is honey. But you want to be careful with these things. I remind everybody we're in the midst of the world's worst epidemic of diabetes and prediabetes.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we've got to be, and this, the magnitude of that problem, I just cannot be overstated. It is such an enormous problem. And I think eliminating wheat is a huge first step. But for some people, it's not the only step. It's got to go farther than that. If you're a guy who's 290 pounds on insulin, having honey is not a good idea.
Yeah. And the weight on the healthcare system overall around the world, I mean, it's bankrupting us in a way. It's incredible. And so, again, we're back to this question. Why is this not touched upon if it's true that all the driving forces here is about the economy? It seems like the government would have an invested interest in trying to turning this around, but it seems like they're making more money on people keeping them sick than having them healthy, unfortunately. I don't know how to explain it.
Well, I think I'm seeing this happen. People who've been teaching or advocating cut your fat, eat more healthy whole grains for decades now, don't want to look stupid. I gave a lecture at a university just recently, and it provoked a lot of criticism among faculty because I believe they were very fearful of looking stupid. So there's going to be resistance. This is not an idea that will gain hold by next Tuesday. This is something that's going to gain ground over time. And I think the reason why it's gaining ground is not because my colleagues have embraced it and not because government agencies advocate it, but because people are seeing what's happening. If you go on my Facebook page for Wheatbelly, for instance, you can't help but notice that post after post after post, every hour, not just once in a while, but every hour, somebody comes on and says, I've done it for 3 weeks. I'm down 18 pounds. My waist is 2 inches smaller. My acid reflux is gone. I haven't felt this much energy in 20 years. I've had my children do it. Their attention spans improve. Their behavior's better. Their school performance, their athletic performance has improved. In other words, I think what's happening here is the grassroots experience is driving this conversation because it's not coming from the official agencies and it's not coming from most of my colleagues. Now, that said, I will tell you, I've been very, very gratified by the number of my colleagues who have talked about this, thought about it, have asked me to come speak to their faculty, have started asking very serious questions. So I think we're at the start of an upheaval in thinking about nutrition, but it's going to take years and years to fully play out.
We're going to round things up here in a little bit. Just one more question about all of this. To me, it seems like the Neolithic or so-called Stone Age diet is among one of the best, as far as I know, at this point anyway. Farming is a particular turn of events in human history. We've done quite a few programs in the past about this as well. Is this something that you've been thinking about when you're, you know, writing and doing this kind of work? Like, why did mankind turn towards wheat and turn towards farming?
Convenience, of course. It smooths out availability of food. So if I return from my hunt empty-handed, but I have a hut or a cave or a mound of grains that I can grind, make porridge or make bread or some other grain-based food, it smooths out need. It also allows me to be more to stay put in one place. Hunting gathering is exhausts the resources fairly quickly. In other words, if I hunt all the antelope and ibex and wild animals in an area, I have to move on, and I have to uplift my family and my hut and where I live. And so there's constant motion. There's this semi-nomadic behavior of hunter-gatherers. When you grow things, you can stay put. But it means some of the most high-yielding and easy-to-grow foods are grains. And so that was the invitation to introducing grains into the human diet. And that's where we... Now, of course, if all we did was turn back the clock 50 years, mm-hmm. I think we would be a lot better off. You know, if we could recreate 1950 today and had slender people where men were 150 pounds and women were 110 pounds, we would be a lot better off. The diets of our parents and grandparents were not perfect, but they were a heck of a lot better than what we have now. Now, those people in the 1950s still got heart disease and cancer and such, so maybe the diet wasn't entirely perfect. But if that's all we did, we would be better off. But I can't help but advocate for ideal health. That is, what if we want to do even better than the people of 1950? We don't want even the smaller occurrence of diabetes, cancer, and heart disease. That's when I think we've got to look deeper into diet.
Absolutely. I agree. This has been very enlightening and informative, William, and we want to thank you very much for your time today. Please tell us your websites again and also where people can go to pick up a copy of the book to find out more and read more about your work.
Oh, sure. The book, of course, is Wheat Belly and available through all conventional ways such as Amazon and bookstores in electronic versions as well as hard copy versions. The blog where a lot of this conversation occurs is the Wheat Belly blog, wheatbellyblog.com, which also has its own Facebook page with the Facebook icon at the top of the page. And that's where I put, by the way, the recipes that I try to make about once a week on the Wheat Belly blog. I've fallen a little behind lately because I'm also writing the Wheat Belly cookbook that's due to come out January 2013, but I'll try to maintain my once-a-week recipe schedule such that everyone is kept abreast of how to make new cookies and muffins.
All right, really good. Thank you again for your time, William.
Oh, my pleasure.
That's our program for today. Sign up for a membership if you haven't already and get access to our archives filled with goodies for you and your friends and family. Sign up for the free newsletter, subscribe to our RSS feeds and YouTube channel and Twitter. And by the way, we also have a Facebook page set up where you can leave comments and get in touch with other listeners. We have about 12,000 people hooked up to the Facebook page right now, so get on there. We have some excellent programs coming your way next on Red Eyes Radio. Mark Weber from the Institute for Historical Review on World War I and II, and of course how this has shaped the geopolitical landscape of today. Then we have Mary Shawn Young, the actress from Blade Runner and Dune, coming on the program talking about her own awakening and how she got into many of the topics that we address here on the program. Don't miss that one, both entertaining and important program. After this, we have Kurt Lindahl, Holland van den Nieuwenhof, Louise Turi, Tom Horn, Liv High, Dean Clifford, Jordan Maxwell, Peter Halldorsson, Neil Kramer, Richard Merrick, Nora Gedgaudas, and Alex Newman, to name a few. All the details are on the website, redeyescreations.com. My thanks to Critic Lana and Elizabeth. We'll be back with more radio in just a few days. Thank you for listening, and take care.